Welcome. My name is Rob Bolo. I'm one of the pediatric neurosurgeons at the University of Utah Primary Children's Hospital, and it's my distinct pleasure to be here today with Heather Spader, who's head of pediatric neurosurgery at the University of New Mexico. And we're launching the initial podcast for the AANS-CNS section on pediatric neurosurgery. We're delighted to have you join us today. This effort, we hope, will lead to many excellent conversations that are thought-provoking and inspiring and educational. This is a new forum for the educational committee of the section to collaborate with one another and to learn from our mentors and peers about the history of our field, current controversies in different aspects of pediatric neurosurgery, the cutting edge of research and clinical practice, as well as career development and providing educational material for practicing neurosurgeons, fellows, and residents, and potentially information for patients and families. This effort will no doubt evolve over time, but we look forward to lively discussions. I'm going to hand it over to Dr. Heather Spader, who will introduce today's guests and is the chair of the podcast subcommittee. Dr. Spader.
Thank you so much. Today, we really are excited to have two guests with us that talk to us about the development of the field of pediatric neurosurgery. And our guests really were instrumental in seeing this field blossom and grow. We talked a lot about the development of the field and leadership and the core values of pediatric neurosurgeons. So I would like you guys to join me in welcoming Dr. Michael Scott from Boston Children's Hospital and Dr. Marion Walker from the University of Utah. And I hope that you enjoy the conversation that we had with them about pediatric neurosurgery.
Thank you all very much for your time and for joining us today. And I think I will just start. I want you all to give a brief introduction of how you started out with your career and your career trajectory, and then we will go from there. So do you want to start, Dr. Walker?
Well, yes. Thank you for inviting me to be a part of this. It sounds like a great project and hopefully it will be interesting. I became interested in pediatric neurosurgery during my residency years, and I managed to somehow figure out a way to go to Toronto for a year of fellowship. Following completion of my training, I entered practice at the Children's Hospital, the Primary Children's Hospital in Salt Lake City. That's a part of the University of Utah, and I've been there the whole time. So I retired in 2016 after 40 years there. I had the privilege of starting early in the era of pediatric neurosurgery. So it allowed me the opportunity to sort of build a program. They did not have pediatric neurosurgeons in Salt Lake City at that time. So it was really one of the highlights of my career to be able to see a program grow.
Dr. Scott?
Yeah, Jack sort of soft-pedaling his role there, but I remember my chief resident was Chuck Rich, who was out in Salt Lake, who was a Salt Lake City resident who went back to Salt Lake City, and he had talked about the way Jack had built that program up from really nothing. So it was an incredible achievement by Jack. I mean, I always wanted to be a pediatric neurosurgeon, and my father was a neurosurgeon, and everybody had asked me, well, was your father a pediatric neurosurgeon? And of course, in those days, there was no such thing. Everybody did everything except in one or two rare places, like I think Chicago, right, Jack? And there were people who did maybe largely pediatrics, but most people were generalists in that day. And I think in the early part of our careers, people were spending a lot of time trying to figure out exactly who was a pediatric neurosurgeon. It usually fell to the youngest member of the faculty. That person got to take care of the shunts, got to take care of the patient problems that nobody else wanted to deal with. But that was something that both Jack and I wanted as our patient population. And when I came to Boston Children's, I had been at Tufts for 15 years and had sort of built up the practice there where there was nothing there. And at Boston Children's, it was a very different hospital when I got there from the way it is now. So a lot has changed, of course, over time.
When you guys, both of you, were instrumental in really establishing a separate board and a separate governing organization, and when you guys first set out to do that, was it difficult? Was there a lot of pushback? What was the environment like when you did that?
Well, there certainly was a lot of pushback. Trying to identify ourselves as pediatric neurosurgeons, it's kind of a long history that we don't have time to go into, but it started with the formation of the ASP in 1978 was the original meeting or the original formation meeting. And the ASPN then began to interact with the American Board of Neurosurgery to try to gain some identity. There's a lot of back and forth. And our leader really was Dave McClone. He was the one willing to stand up and take the heat. And the rest of us just kept giving him good advice or bad advice. But Dave stood up and kind of was the point man that the board kind of pointed to. He's the bad guy.
Yeah, I think they looked on us as the rogue board. And I think our job, if you can correct me here, Jack, if I'm wrong about this, but I think we were very concerned about making sure that the standards for the Board of Pediatric Neurosurgery were as high as they possibly could be, and that people who were being designated as pediatric neurosurgeons had a practice that was primarily in pediatric neurosurgery. They had specific training, they had specific interests, and it was a career dedication to pediatric neurosurgery that made this special. And I remember, maybe you remember this too, Jack, at the pediatric section, I debated Marty Weiss at one of the sections about whether pediatric neurosurgery really had to exist as a separate specialty or not. I think that was 1980 or 1981, and there was a tremendous reaction to that sort of desire on the part of the pediatric neurosurgeons to make themselves into something not only unique, but something that was vetted and where the patients were protected. I think the thing we always talked about was making sure the patients get the best care. And if we looked at it on that high level plane, our cause was going to always win out.
Yeah, that was a very strong feeling amongst all the leadership that the requirements had to at least mirror the American Board of Neurosurgery requirements.
Yeah, and I remember
that's why we created an accreditation council to inspect and certify fellowships. And the certification of a pediatric neurosurgeon is separate from the accreditation council. Again, mirroring the neurosurgery world where the RRC is separate from the adult board.
Yeah, and I remember those steps that Dave McClone and all those early founders talked about, you know, getting your own journal going and getting your own examination process going. Remember, we had our own exam committees. We formulated our own exams, and we tried to make everything as rigorous and honest as it could be, with trying to avoid any old boy. And I think they were mostly old boys then.
Networks, for sure.
Avoiding that. Yeah.
What are the biggest changes that you've seen in the field since you all started?
Well, I started before CT scan. So
MRIs are really...
The CT scan came along, as I think I was a junior in my residency. I think if you had to pick the biggest change is medical imaging. I mean, we've gone from sticking carotids in the middle of the night and doing air studies to what we have today. Those first CT images were so pixelated, looking back on them, it just makes you cringe. But we thought they were the most beautiful things in the world. It was truly amazing. So I would say imaging has been, and by that I'm including things like navigation and all the tools that we have today.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'd agree with Jack there. But I always, when I give my lectures on cavernous malformations, I always start off with that first CT scan that when I was a chief resident, I had never operated on a cavernous malformation. My entire 5-year residency until the CT came along in my last 6 months, and there was the CT done on this patient. And you mentioned pixelated, one of those old ME scans showing the lesion and operating and finding the lesion. You know, I was going to also say, Jack, I was thinking about the subspecialization that probably is taking place in pediatric neurosurgery as we speak right now. I mean, it's incredible. You think of your colleague, think of Doug Brockmeyer and what his practice is like, or Arnold Menezes, or individuals who grabbed onto a particular topic or a subsection of pediatric neurosurgery and run with it and developed it to such an extent that the field has been advanced tremendously. I think that is a big, big change. Because when we started out, everybody did everything, and everybody did everything in pediatric neurosurgery.
They did. And that was always one of the attracting things for residents picking a fellowship is, As a pediatric neurosurgeon, you still got to do everything, so to speak.
Yeah.
But those changes have come. And I think in a way, the subspecialization within pediatric neurosurgery is a way of proving pediatric neurosurgery was necessary. I'm not sure I'm saying that correctly, but it sort of validates pediatric neurosurgery, because we have within our own sort of small group, so to speak, the opportunity to subspecialize.
And I hope this is not a failing of mine as a chief, but when I took over at Boston Children's in 1988, one of the things that I wanted to do was to developed that subspecialization within pediatric neurosurgery, for better or for worse. And in each of my hires, as the years progressed, I wanted people to come on to take special areas and really develop them. And I think that it's made a big difference in our department. At the same time, I noticed, for example, when I'm in clinic and seeing patients, I'm a little more uncomfortable seeing, for example, a craniosynostosis patient than I used to be. I mean, that was all of our bread and butter. And, you'd identify those cases and you'd say, I know just what to do with this patient. And now when I see those cases, I make the diagnosis, but I tend to talk to Mark Proctor and say, Mark, what do you think about this case? How should we handle it? That makes me feel guilty.
I do the same. I see a patient with a spine problem, I say, call Doug.
Yeah.
We need to talk.
Well, I know, but one of the questions that Heather was going to ask us, right, was one of the appeals of pediatric neurosurgery is that we're still one of the specialties where everybody can do everything. Mm-hmm. And that certainly was what I loved about it and still do love about it. But I have a feeling we're starting to get away from that.
Yeah. And the follow-up question was, as you have this subspecialization and then you're thinking about training fellows, How does that impact the training when you have maybe that one person does mostly just spine or one person only does craniosynostosis? Do you think that affects the training for better or for worse?
I think it affects it in a positive way. At least at our program, for example, the fellows come out of there with a great experience in spine, and they know if that's something they want to pursue in their own careers. And I think they feel comfortable if they make that choice. They've got a good experience with seizure, with synostosis and so forth. So I don't think it detracts. I think it's still up to the person being trained to make the decisions about how they will focus or not as they go forward.
Heather, how long are you out of your fellowship now?
6 years.
6 years. I mean, that's a question that you should answer, really. I mean, you think about your training and who you work with there. I mean, I've always felt that it's been a real asset for the fellows to have all these experts around them who are expert, like Jack said, experts in spine, craniosynostosis, vascular, congenital anomalies. I can't think of learning any, you know, ventriculoscopy from anyone better than Ben Warf, for example, or, you know, to have those guys around is just, I think, remarkably good for the fellows. So I like that part of it.
Well, and I would say I found, you know, being out after fellowship, if you got some complicated vascular thing or you got some complicated hydrocephalus thing, even if you didn't train at Boston Children's, you could always email Ed Smith or Ben Warf and they would always help you. And so knowing, well, wait a second, I know that Dr. Scott and Ed Smith have seen so much vascular and this is a kind of strange thing. I know where to go to see if they can give us some advice. So I think that is very valuable, no matter where you train, to have those experts in the field.
Yeah, I think that's a wonderful thing about our field too, is that we're still small and we still all know each other. I'm beginning to worry about this as I head off to the pediatric section in Salt Lake City, and it'll be very interesting to see, you know, with a couple of years hiatus, how many of us do know each other. But that is a wonderful thing about our group, isn't it? That we still know everybody around the country.
We're getting to a point, Mike, where we know each other. We just can't remember them.
Yeah. Oh, that's right.
That's why we have name tags, right?
Well, yeah, but then we can't see them.
That's true. Okay. Well, yeah. I want to take this opportunity just to introduce my partner in this, Rob Bolo, who's a pediatric neurosurgeon at the University of Utah. And he was doing what we do a lot, tapping a shunt. So thank you for joining us, Rob.
Of course. I'm sorry I'm late. I'm in Las Vegas. We, every 4 months, spend a week at Sunrise Hospital here and are trying to, Intermountain is trying to sort of expand its care into Nevada. And so we have a physician here, Dr. Bragg, and we give her a break every once in a while. So we come down and cover. So it's a very interesting, different, you know, different place where you're sort of on your own. And so I apologize for being late. But.
Well, put a bet on the Celtics for me, would you, when you're out there?
I certainly can, Dr. Scott.
So just going a little bit, I want to talk a little bit about the leadership and the future of the field. And both of you all know kind of what it takes to be a really good pediatric neurosurgeon. What do you think are the most important qualities and values for the next generation of leaders in pediatric neurosurgery?
Let's you lead off with that, Mike.
Yeah, that's a tough one, isn't it? I mean, there are some obvious answers, I guess, to that, Heather, aren't there? I mean, you have to be, I look at the answer to that in the way you'd say, who do you want to run your department of pediatric neurosurgery, for example, and what are the qualities of a good leader? And, you know, they involve being, I think, an excellent technical surgeon. I always think that's very important. I think someone who has charisma and who has empathy for their patient and who is more than just a technician. And I think one of the great things about people with a bent towards pediatrics is that they are all more than technicians. And they, I mean, our group as general tends to be interested in patients and their families and children. And it's an easy matter to have those qualities in most circumstances. And I think all of us in training know that when someone comes along who doesn't fill that mold, we recognize it and we know they're in the wrong business. Yeah. So I would say empathy for patients and great technicians and charisma, good leadership qualities. Things, by the way, I think probably you don't learn at Harvard Business School.
Well, I certainly agree with what you've said, Mike. The great privilege of being a pediatric neurosurgeon is growing up with our patients. We take care of chronic disease so much, and we see our patients over and over. And there are very few specialties where you can bond as strongly as we have the opportunity and the privilege to do so. So treasure that. Don't ever let it become routine. I think that's important to remember going forward as a young pediatric neurosurgeon. I think one of the things I see over time is sometimes the reliance on technology removes us a little bit from that kind of feeling. Maybe I'm not expressing this correctly, but if you have a failure of your computer in the operating room, are you still able to find the exact location of where that tumor is? It just sometimes appears to me that some of our trainees wouldn't be able to find it if they couldn't look at the scan first. So use imaging and use technology to its advantage, but don't forget to be the whole neurosurgeon as you go forward.
I think your point, Jack, about the following of the patients is extremely important. I've been a big advocate in our service for long-term follow-up of patients. I mean, it's a mutually beneficial relationship with your patients that you talked about there, and following them for long periods of time, and also finding out about disease processes and what happens to patients and what their lives turn out to be like. These are things we don't talk about too much, and which is something that, for example, at our neuro-oncology conferences, I always have to remind my colleagues about. I mean, they always think about the scan in front of them, but don't think about what's happening, going to happen tomorrow, and what the patients have been put through and what trials that they have suffered for the sake of what their families have suffered. And so these are very important aspects of our job. And I think that continuing follow-up is something we've been lucky to have.
I think one of the things that both of you all have done exceedingly well is maintaining that empathy and care for the patients, despite, we have patients with horrible diseases, with horrible outcomes that aren't necessarily our fault. It's the nature of the disease. And you see some people will wall themselves off, and their defense mechanism is maybe not to deal with it or to lose empathy. How have you been able to maintain the balance of really keeping that empathy, but not losing yourself in some of the tragedies that we see in our patients?
Mm. Yeah, there's a very good question. And I don't know whether there's a one size fits all answer to that, Heather. I know it's interesting to me that early in my career, when a patient died with a malignant brain tumor, let's say, I did not go to the funeral. I mean, I would send the family a note, but I didn't want, I was afraid of getting too deeply involved. And as I got older, I gradually changed my mind. And when those events occurred, particularly in families that I had had long associations with, I went to the funerals and I saw how their grief manifested itself. And I also felt that I was part of the extended family, and it meant a great deal to me. And I think that's something it took me a long time to get to do, because there's too much going on in our lives. And sometimes you just don't have time emotionally to give that of yourself. But I found that very worthwhile. So I only bring that up anecdotally to say that that balance is very, very hard. And I don't know what individual answers are, but I also want to put in a plug for behavior on rounds when you're going around seeing patients. I notice that everybody has a style, but some of doctors have a style that the rounds are handled from the doorway and there's a very casual discussion. And I always felt that that was absolutely wrong. You had to go in, you had to talk to the family, you had to sit by the bedside. You had to make the families feel that you had all the time in the world to hear what they wanted to talk about. There were other things you had to do, but you had all the time in the world for them, even if you didn't have it. And I think those things made me a better doctor. I remember patients outside the room they were problem patients and difficult patients, and I didn't want to go in that room. And I always had to talk to myself, Mike, be a doctor. And then I could go in that room and sit there and see the patient.
Well, you hit the nail on the head, Mike. You got to care and you have to listen. If you don't listen, I think the patient's families pick up on it. And it's just so important. I think, you know, we choose pediatric neurosurgery because we do care. So hopefully you maintain that throughout your career. It's just so vital.
I'll just say that I learned a lot of that from you, Dr. Walker, and I feel, you know, our hospital has this commit to sit program, and I think that that's really important, Dr. Scott. I think that, you know, no one knows the child better than the parents, no matter what. And you may have the medical knowledge, but they know the child better. And I think you have to acknowledge that. And that's an important part of the component. And I think I learned from Dr. Walker to sit and to acknowledge their opinion and their thoughts and give them validity, and then tell them why I might be reassured or why it might not be as clear cut or, you know, what I might be concerned about. But I think that it has to start with giving them your time and acknowledging, you know, that their opinion matters as a parent, because no one knows them better.
Very well said, Rob. I think that, I also like bringing the family into the discussions about treatment. I hate having the discussions outside the door where you go over vital signs, you go over everything, then you go over plan, then you go into the room. I want the families to hear all that stuff. I mean, if it were me in that bed, I want to hear it all. Sure. You know, yeah. Unless it's something you absolutely can't discuss in front of the family. But I think that's what you said is very important.
If it's okay, can I tell a little story about Dr. Walker that I took me 10 years to learn?
Careful.
So when I was a fellow, there was a really sick girl on service quite a bit with an encephaloceal. She had a very bad encephaloceal and microcephaly and epilepsy and very dysmorphic small ventricles. And she was repetitively in shunt failure. And she had a lot of cystic regions where the shunt was. And she kept getting emergently revised. And it was right at the beginning of my fellowship. And then I remember seeing this child with Dr. Walker in clinic. And, you know, Dr. Walker asked me what I thought. And we talked about doing a craniotomy to try to open up some of those cystic areas to see if we could get the shunt working better. And she didn't really have any quality of life. I mean, she, you know, she was a spastic quadriplegic, and she didn't communicate, and she was had a very high seizure burden, but her family certainly loved her. You know, that would never be our decision to say, you know. So we went and Dr. Walker let me do the surgery, and she didn't wake up. And, you know, it was near her. It was an occipital encephaloceal, and some of those cystic regions were near her you know, critical structures, her diencephalon and her superior brainstem. And I carried that for a long time, and I felt horrible about it, and I still do. And but Dr. Walker never he felt like it was, maybe it was the right thing. Maybe she was in and out of the hospital. Not the right thing that that happened, but maybe you know, she was in a situation where we could get a shunt working, and if we couldn't do that, you know, maybe this was the best thing. And I remember him saying that to me, and I could never understand it. And then I recently had a young parent who was their first child with a very bad encephaloceal with a sinus anatomy there. And I think I talked to my partners, you know, very senior, well-known neurosurgeons. And one of them talked about doing kind of trying to be innovative and trying to do something kind of outside the box. And I think the other one said I wouldn't offer them surgery. And I don't think the parents were ready for either of those things. And I think I learned the lesson that Dr. Walker was trying to teach me 10 years before, which was I did surgery, I staged it. Child's ultimately done fine from a surgical perspective. But I think I needed to sort of meet them where they were. And they were grappling with dealing with a child with this difficult neurologic condition. And I needed to walk with them and through that experience and deal with them and let them make the decisions and not try to do anything too crazy or high risk, but also offer them treatment and get them to a point where, you know, maybe there'll be a time down the line when they feel like things are different, but for now, this is what they want and that's appropriate. And we don't always have all the answers. And I think being there and walking with that family through that path is, I feel like, a big part of this job and about what, you know, what just makes it fulfilling for me. And I think I just recently learned that lesson 10 years later. So I'm always learning from Dr. Walker, even though.
You learned that lesson early, Rob. Don't worry.
I think the compassion of finding that middle ground and meeting families where they are, I think, is so important to being a pediatric neurosurgeon. I just wanted to tell that story and acknowledge that that I learned that from Dr. Walker and still do to this day.
Nice compliment, Rob.
No, thanks.
I guess this is a little bit of a long question with multiple parts. So, but in terms of where the field is headed today, what do you think are the most exciting opportunities, the most challenging problems, and what concerns do you have about the future of the specialty?
Well, I can start with some things that have been on my mind. I mean, this may not be everything, Jack. I'll be interested in your thoughts about this. You know, I've been very interested in the changes that have gone on with brain tumor treatment and with the molecular and genetic bases of brain tumors and where that's all going to lead. And, you know, there are certain of the tumors that we treat, I've always felt, although we operate on them, they're not surgical diseases. Medulloblastoma, I've never thought, is a surgical disease. I've always rebelled against this theory that you have to take out everything down to the last quarter centimeter of tumor or whatever the current standard is, and knowing that the tumor is mopped up by treatments that aren't surgical. And even if we've taken everything out grossly, we've left stuff behind in most of those cases. So, I mean, the fact that there's a molecular basis for managing treatment to me makes a lot of sense, and I think is an exciting development in the specialty. What there's a corollary to that, which is disturbing, and that is that, and I don't know what it's like, Rob, for you or Heather or Jack at your neuro-oncology conferences in your institution, but I find that the oncologists now are talking about the patients in terms of the molecular basis of their tumor rather than the patients. And the fact is we don't have treatments for many of these different molecular breakdowns and genetic breakdowns of tumors, yet the patients are being categorized this way without any real thought as to where the next steps are. And we're not, the diagnosis is proceeding, but the treatment is not. So that's an area where I think we've got to make huge advances. And you think about some other areas that Heather and Rob are exactly the same now as they were when Jack and I were kids in the specialty. Pontine gliomas, I think, pretty much the same as it was when we started. Malignant gliomas of the brain and children, I mean, we know there's some things that alter prognosis, but the ultimate outcome, pretty much the same as it was when we started. So there are some things that I'm very excited about in the future, and I'm very excited about some of the technology, but there's also counterbalances there as well.
Forgive me for being delusional, but one of the things I'm excited about is the future of hydrocephalus. You know, it's in Mike and my and our careers, we've seen no change. I mean, we've seen a few little tweaks of the shunt mechanism or this or that, but we haven't seen great change until more recently. And I think the Hydrocephalus Association, if I can put in a plug for them, has made a huge difference. They have raised amazing amounts of money to support research. They have funded young investigators who have gone on to get significant NIH funds. So I think basic science is improving. I'm excited about some of the pharmacology possibilities with hydrocephalus. I'm excited that some of the shunt manufacturers, when they start thinking about a new shunt, they're not thinking about the same old. They're starting to think, how can we improve to make something really better? I'm just excited that there is a dialogue going on about hydrocephalus and about ways that we can improve it in the future. So it's going to get better. It's going to take time, but it's going to get better. That's one of the things I'm really excited about going forward.
Interesting. It's obviously in many ways the bane of our existence. And when you look at the shunt design, like you said, not a lot of improvements. And I have found the people that have the most interesting ideas are some of my parents that are plumbers, electricians, like in the trades. And one parent, he's in oil and gas. And he's like, well, I don't understand why you don't have a sensor in there that tells the rate of flow constantly. So you always have that recorded. And I was like, yeah. He's like, well, we have that kind of stuff all the time in the oil and gas industry. We need to know how much it's flow, the rate it's flowing. And I was like, seems so simple, yeah. You know, but those kinds of things, I think we do have more ability to put the chip in the shunt and then be able to download the data like we do with RNSs for epilepsy and those kinds of things. But
well, it's going to happen. They're talking about it seriously,
which would be great.
Yeah.
If you had like $1 million to spend to make the field better, where would you put it?
To make me feel better?
It's a kind of a, you know, like if you had, or if you, or just if you had limitless amount of funding, where do you think would have the greatest effect, or what would you, you know, if you're kind of like a pipe dream, where would you want to put that money?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is the generic term research. I would like to see a significant amount of that go to hydrocephalus research. But I'd also, if I had limited amounts of money, if and we all know some people who seem to have that, I think we need to look more at the general health of places around the world that need it much more than we do. Put some funding into you know, I mean, we can shunt patients in third world countries, but we need to put funding into training people who can not only put in the shunt, but can take care of the patients and follow them for various diseases. Basically, it's education.
Yeah, that's a good point about education, Jack. As I reminded, you know, we're in the process of fellow interviews right now, and one of the applicants we interviewed, she had been to Uganda, and I started asking her about the merits of this, you know, medical missionary sort of stuff and how it was. And it turned out that she was the one who was being educated because in Uganda, you know, Ben's old hospital there, he's trained up all those people and they were teaching her how to do the procedures that they were doing day in and day out there, and with a facility that many of us have not approached because they're doing them so frequently. I thought that was a very telling anecdote there. If in certain areas, if you can do these things right, you get people educated there and they're going to end up taking care of their own folk instead of the sort of the medical missionary stuff that so many of us have been doing over the past. But I think the question of money, I don't know. One of my failings as a chief was when people made these big donations, I had a hard time figuring out where to put the money. And I was always thinking, Heather, about training. And my big mantra when I had money was trying to bring people in from abroad so that we could pay their salaries so that they could be trained up and go back home and, you know, and do the sorts of things that we've just been talking about. I guess the problem is that so many people didn't want to go back home when they came.
Rob, do you have any other questions you want to add?
No, I think that I was interested in, you know, this sort of theme that I've been listening to about sort of technology versus the human element of being a physician and a neurosurgeon. I think, you know, I think as we look at the role technology is playing, like, you know, there are people that feel that, you know, neural radiology could be replaced by machine learning algorithms and probably pathology by molecular diagnosis. And I don't, obviously we're procedural based specialty, but there's a tension there between the technology driving, you know, advancements and standardizing things so we can get better at them. But then being a, you know, the doctor that's, you know, there for the family and the patient. And I don't know how to navigate that. I don't know how to make sure as we sort of go through that revolution, we have the appropriate balance.
You know, I think about this a lot, Rob. And when I think about it the most is when I go to the M&M conferences, and we have shared M&M once a month with the adult service. And I hope I'm not telling any tales out of school here, but it seems to me that most of the cases that we see that have significant morbidity or mortality are ones that all you have to do is hear three sentences of the opening vignette about the patient, and you know exactly what's going to happen. Yeah. This patient has so many comorbidities, is old and frail, is not, and you just know what's going to happen. It's the philosophy that if you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And I think that if we can inculcate in our trainees the idea that not every patient needs to go directly to the operating room, that we have to think a little bit. And as you mentioned, put ourselves in the family's shoes and walk with them and understand what the major issues are, then we can in good conscience recommend what we think is best. The phrase I hate to hear is, well, we offered the patient this and the patient decided this. You don't offer the patient, you tell them what you think should be done, but you reason with them as well. And I think that's what you've said is very important.
Yeah, it seems like we're headed into this. I think that understanding our core values as we sort of see the transformation of medicine through technology is really critical. Mm-hmm. I think having a conversation about that is important. So.
But when you go to the M&M conference, just like you just described, Mike, I think they're probably pretty universal. When the pediatric group goes once a month over to the adult side and listens to the M&M, and when they start with this 78-year-old lady with diabetes and gout, you know immediately they're making an excuse for why the complication occurred.
Yes, that's true. And of course, when they say this 78-year-old elderly individual, then I get a little concerned.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, you're right. I mean, but it's also learning a little bit more about the patient and trying to figure out whether that surgery is going to work for that frail elderly patient who doesn't have platelets and who has concomitant lymphoma. And, you know, it gets to be pretty strange at times sometimes. And we have a rescue fantasy.
I have a question for you both. As I sort of get to the middle of my career, collaboration seems more and more important. And not that I didn't value it initially, but it's becoming clearly important, whether it's, you know, with our colleagues who have special expertise in different areas of pediatric neurosurgery, or with our other subspecialists who take care of, you know, complex children in a multidisciplinary fashion with us, or trying to make the hospital a better place through administration, or, you know, as a community of pediatric neurosurgeons or neurosurgeons more broadly. It just seems like Jack said, being able to listen, but also just collaboration seems to be really, really important. And I'd love to hear, you know, what you guys think of that and the role you think it plays in your success.
I can tell you, Rob, that, I mean, from my standpoint, I've been actually pretty concerned about this, because in my own interactions with the other subspecialties, I find that we tend to get more and more siloed. I was looking at my CV a month ago, and I was seeing how many papers I had written in the first half of my career where there was collaboration with the orthopods, with the neurologists, with the radiologists, with the oncologists, and a lot of them. And my favorite papers were papers that I wrote with the radiologists, for example, where, you know, there was, as Jack pointed out, this has been the year of discovery in that area. And we've discovered a lot about anatomy in our own patients with that. But as I look at my work product over the past 10 years, I see that less and less and less as these individuals become more and more busy with churning out the cases, getting their RVUs done, and less and less interest in academic productivity. And I've actually found that in my own particular case, there's been less collaboration than there was earlier. And I've been worried about it. I don't know what Jack has noticed, or actually what you or Heather have noticed in your own work.
I don't think I've noticed a lack of collaboration between the various specialties. I hear what you're saying, Mike, and I may have to rethink that to some degree, but I haven't noticed a real change there.
Have you had any opportunity in your conferences, for example, to say at a radiology conference when an interesting case is shown and somebody says, oh yeah, we have five of those cases, and somebody says, oh, we ought to get those cases together and write that up, and or let's look at this. Usually nothing happens.
I'm not sure that's not necessarily the fault of the radiologist or the cancer group. It's the fault of all of us for just not getting it done.
Yeah, we're busy. I think we're busy.
Well, we are busy. And the era where you are required to have certain amounts of busyness that can interfere with a lot of things.
Yeah.
We were fortunate not to go through that.
Yeah. So I'm guessing there were no RVUs when you started.
Right.
And I'm guessing you saw the introduction of that system. Do you think that has been detrimental? Opening Pandora's box asking, but I'm just curious, you know, how you've seen it change the way we practice.
I don't know. This is an area that has discouraged, has concerned me for years, Heather. And when I had my meetings, I guess I can tell these stories now. When I have my meetings every year with the CEO of the hospital, you know, I would go over with them that, you know, the cases we had done, everybody's academic achievements, people with positions on various boards, and how we were enhancing the reputation of the hospital, I felt. And the bottom line message always would be from them, well, you've got to increase your throughput. You know, we want you to increase your patient volume by another 5% this year. And I was always saying, you know, wait a minute, I can do that if you give me more operating time and you give me more ancillary personnel. Sure, we'll be happy to do that. But that was the emphasis on those discussions, which always bothered me. It was not even the RVU aspect of things. It was the money. And then they would counter with, which is absolutely true, no margin, no mission. You have to make the money to get the stuff done. And we're always right in the middle of that business part of medicine. We have to make money to make sure we can do what we want to do. And we have to be able to employ everyone who is under us. But it means having a business mind too. So the RVU stuff is here to stay, isn't it?
It is the way it is. Yeah. Well, I thank you both very much for your time. We really appreciate your wisdom and your thoughts. So I look forward to seeing all of you in Salt Lake City. We hope that that happens. It's only less than a month away.
It's going to happen. It's going to be fun. Yeah.
I think so.
It'll be fun.
Yeah. After 2 years, it will be.
I will say that I went to the Congress meeting in Austin, and it was very well attended.
Yeah.
There was a big crowd there, and they handled it very well. I mean, you had to prove your vaccination status. You needed to wear your mask, but it was very, very well attended.
Well, good to hear.
And I think that's probably kind of a bellwether for whether or not the section will be.
Mm-hmm. And you know, Jack, our band played 3 times at that meeting. We had a ball in Austin.
I know.
So what a great city.
You're supposed to be there.
Yeah. So looking forward to seeing you in Salt Lake, Jack.
Me too. Thank you. You looking forward to seeing all of you.